games and music were always seemingly bound to converge at some point, just given that it was sort of my two biggest loves.
Hi, hello, welcome along to Press X to continue. My name is Stefan Powell. We make a games podcast here that we put out on Apple, Spotify, and all the different podcast places every Tuesday. So you should go and check that out there. If you're into the games industry, if you like talking about video games, then this is a place for you. Every week we will look at the latest news. We'll also talk about the titles that we love, the ones that we don't love maybe as much as well. We'll reminisce about old games that make us smile and laugh still, and also look ahead as to what is coming down the track. So whatever you need to know about games, we talk about it basically on the podcast. And you can find us every Tuesday. But from time to time, we get these brilliant guests to come on and talk to us, right? And we think, tell you what, why don't we share that with people on YouTube as well? Which is exactly what we're doing this week. So our audience wanted us to get under the bonnet of games composing, making music for video games. And so there was one name that we wanted to get on straight away to come and have a chat to us all about it. And that is Austin Wintory. Now, most famous, I guess, for his work, his beautiful, moving work on the game Journey. He's also worked on big AAA blockbusters like Assassin's Creed and Lego Fortnite as well. So it's a fascinating conversation with Austin about how you make music for games. So welcome to the Continue Club. Get settled in and enjoy this chat with Austin. We'll come on to the story where we're in the same room immediately, in fact, because I was in a room where the cello solo from Journey was played by the London Symphony Orchestra. It's the BBC Proms. I was presenting the Proms on stage at the Albert Hall that night, and I was stood 10 feet away from the cellist of the London Symphony Orchestra who played that solo live in that venue. You were there in the audience, and there was a very touching moment where all the composers stood up and were given a round of applause. But I could almost touch him, and the hairs on the back of my neck, Austin, couldn't have been higher up than they were. Like a breathtaking moment for me, and I listened to that song regularly. So, you know, we had to have you on. And obviously, naturally, when you do an interview, you want to go right to the beginning and do things sort of chronologically. But can we just jump in on that song? Because it's one of my favourites from games. How did you get about writing that and the riff, the melody, and the decision to have it on the cello? How did it come about?
Well, I will interject one small parenthesis. First off, that experience of attending the Proms when they did their first ever gaming program was a life highlight. I flew out just for that. I landed that morning and was back on my way to LA the following morning. I mean, it was one of those.
Yeah,
it was one of those. I can't miss this. It's too exciting. It was one of those sort of bucket list things. You know, you always see the Proms every summer. You see this series of concerts, and it's like a non-existent bucket list, because you think that'll never happen. So it's not really a goal, but how amazing could that be to see them put game music on stage? And that alone would be amazing. But to dare to dream that one's own music could be part of that, certainly as well. If you'll forgive me being slightly pedantic as
no,
a point of order,
do.
It was in fact the Royal Philharmonic, a separate ensemble from the London
of
Symphony.
Of course it was. Of course and, it was. The Royal Philharmonic. I've got that entirely right. You're right. It shows how good my memory was.
The LSO typically performs at the Barbican. I'm sure they've done Albert Hall before, but they tend to have their own home bases. But that cellist was Richard Harwood, who played the solo in Journey really, really magnificently. I've been lucky enough that Journey has been played by ensembles all over the world. And the original recording was done by Tina Guo, who's, you know, not even human. She's just among the most superhumanly talented musicians to walk the earth. And so, as you can imagine, I've heard, we'll say, a wide range of performances of that piece. And, you know, I'm grateful when anyone is interested in doing my music. And I when it's live, I actually don't really, I don't want to say I don't care, but I sort of don't care how it turns out, because live music is ephemeral. I care so much more that everyone is enjoying themselves and that the audience engage and connect with the musicians, because the audience is not going to be sitting there ideally kind of mentally comparing it to some other performer who's not there in front of them, or to a recording or whatever. Hopefully they're just in the moment, you know, and appreciating it for what it is. So I kind of like that, you know, sometimes it might be a little rough, or sometimes it might just be very different. It might just be sort of interpreted in a way that I never imagined. But that's the whole joy of live music. So anyway, none of which is what you actually asked me. My apologies.
But no, not at all. This look, we're quite a, you know, we're just interested in having a chat, Austin, and we will get on to the things that we get on to. We don't have a specific agenda here, really. But no, that was quite the moment, wasn't it? I mean, it was interesting. You were saying it was a bucket list for you. It was a bucket list as well for me, because to get to present a show on the stage of the Albert Hall is quite something. And what was brilliant is
I can only imagine.
You know, but also to give game music the platform it deserves, alongside all the other different forms of classical music that you can, you know, hear from the Symphony Orchestra. You know, it was a magical moment. Brilliantly conducted. It was Robert Ames, wasn't it, the conductor?
Yep. Yep.
And fantastic flowing hair. Amazing.
Yes.
Flowing hair. Like,
yes,
beautiful.
He has beautiful Eric Whitaker hair. And Rob is a great musician, of course, but also, as per his role with the London Contemporary Orchestra, he's a huge advocate for contemporary music in all of its guises, whether that's you know, sort of modern classical, so-called, or you know, composers writing film music, video game music, yeah, television music, that sort of thing. He's a real ally to us, you know, note scratchers. But particularly, you know, the London Contemporary Orchestra's whole claim to fame is their kind of, I don't like this term avant-garde, because it sort of brings baggage that I don't actually mean, but just basically anything that's sort of intrinsically boundary pushing, whatever that boundary might be, that's sort of the purview of the London Contemporary Orchestra. So he's especially no stranger to things that are trying to be unconventional. It's not just that it's new insofar as if I write this note, then that note, then this note. Yes, it's new, but it's people that are pulling at even more fundamental threads than that. That's his domain. And yeah, and games are such a home for that kind of thing. The conductor / author / many other things, a guy named John Maucheri, has said to me before that he thinks games are now the true avant-garde, meaning where is there something that's truly new, and the idea of music being interactive is truly new. And so he says, you know, the avant-garde of the old days was writing a piece of music where, you know, it's someone hitting two sticks together and then a guy in a clown suit walks by or something like that. That's the traditional avant-garde, like the mid-20th century, the idea of, you know, performance art, basically, or, you know, the John Zorn kind of thing where you're playing an instrument and breaking down the sounds where it's not even really playing notes. It's like screeching, you know, like Yoko Ono kind of territory. That's the traditional avant-garde, if there is such even a concept as traditional avant-garde. That's like the old fashioned. But he says now it's less about the music itself and the idea of just of challenging the format, and the idea of interactive music in the context of a game pulls at the format in a way that is so different from all prior history, because the player is now the player / sort of listener is a co-author in the experience. That's why, in a way, funny enough, despite all the reverence that I say for being at the Albert Hall that day, putting game music on stage is actually taking away a fundamental component of what makes it what it is.
Yeah, and you know, I hadn't thought of it like that, but you're right, because there isn't that element of interactivity. Although it's interesting you're saying, and we've spent a lot of time beginning this episode talking about sort of listening to...
I haven't even answered your question.
No. but, you know, like listening to orchestras play game music and things, because that is such a growing trend. It's a growing income stream for the games industry. You know, I've just seen advertised on my Instagram. It's just popped up. There's a Metal Gear concert being played at the Albert Hall later on this year, and you've seen the Final Fantasy VII tours.
They did an Elden Ring show there.
They've done an Elden Ring show
last year, I think.
Yeah, they've done the work. So it's really becoming, you know, people are really clearly seeing that audiences are vibing with the music that they listen to, because they spend so much time. I spend so much time listening to your soundtrack to Journey because I played through that game, and people have a relationship with that that is deeper sometimes than listening to an album for 30 minutes in a car. So you can see why that growth is getting there, and no doubt we will see more of that coming. You're right though, it does sort of fundamentally change the relationship, because you're not forcing the interactivity to change. But look, I'm going to come on to that later on, because I've got a very specific question for you on that.
Okay.
But what we should probably do is figure out, Austin, how you ended up being stood up that night at the Albert Hall, being clapped for your work, and how you are here with us chatting about video game music as the composer of some fine works in games that we all know and love, from Assassin's Creed all the way through to more slightly independent titles like Luna and Journey, of course. But you've also made music for Alien and Lego and a whole range of stuff. How did it all happen?
Well, God only knows. I mean, it's a crazy... All our lives are these dominoes where it can be difficult to pinpoint where the motion was set, as it were. And in my case, I had always loved games growing up. In fact, I didn't really get into music until I was around 10. But I had been playing games. My gaming memories kind of go back to the sort of event horizon of memory. I don't really remember a time where I wasn't playing, you know, Atari later, you know, or like Nintendo subsequently, you know, every SNES, Genesis. In the 90s, when I was sort of really coming of age, I became a big PC gamer. And so I don't really have a time in my life where it wasn't really central.
Yeah.
And I always loved creative stuff. I wanted to be a novelist, or I wanted to be a filmmaker. I actually wanted to be a game designer at one point as well. I was studying computer programming and things, thinking that because I had fallen in love with music by that point, but I sort of thought being a composer was a pipe dream. And so maybe it's a little bit more practical to imagine joining the game industry initially as an engineer, but with the long-term ambition of making my own games. And then at some point I said, you know, I actually really love music more than writing code. So I kind of shifted gears and became single-minded. But the point being that games and music were always seemingly bound to converge at some point, just given that it was sort of my two biggest loves. Now, I really, more fundamentally, I love the medium, the various mediums of storytelling. So I love film, I love television. You know, film scoring has been a big part of my life as well, although obviously game scoring has been sort of the dominant thing, or at least the more likely. I've scored a lot of movies you've never heard of, whereas I've been lucky to work on games that you may have heard of. And so, I mean, look, that, so it's sort of one of those where it becomes this infinite regress of going, well, where did it start? And before you know it, you're in the world of, you know, physics talking about the Big Bang and saying, well, do you really want to be fundamental about it? Because I mean, the truth is I had this love of both of those things. And so any moment that could potentially mix them was bound to catch me. That moment happened to come in college, where the sort of medium length version of the story is that I was at a concert and I started talking to a guy sitting next to me. And it turned out we were both students at the University of Southern California. And it turned out he was a student in their game design program. I didn't even know they had a game design program. I was attracted to the school because, I mean, yes, they have a great music program, but also I knew they had a great film program. And I thought, oh, I can make the next Steven Spielberg if I just go to this school and I hang around the cinema department. And so I was busy scoring student films and stuff in pursuit of that, because at the time games were mostly scored in-house. And I knew I wanted to pursue a freelance composer who could do theater, who could do film music, who could do whatever I wanted. The idea of having a 9-to-5 job as a staff composer didn't seem like a fit for me.
Yeah.
And usually that also meant broadly audio person. It didn't mean composer. It meant you're also doing sound design and editing dialogue, because that's the way it was in the 90s and in the 80s. Music was done almost essentially exclusively. Rare exceptions, but essentially exclusively by staff in-house folks who had multiple audio-related responsibilities. And it's a testament to how brilliant those, you know, the Koji Kondos of the world truly are, that that in the capacity of like a 9-to-5 company man would write such iconic music. Because, you know, they had multiple tasks and it's just astounding. Yeah, so in any case, I had kind of assumed game music was not on the menu because I wasn't aware that in that moment, there was a bit of a change in the tides happening where freelance game music was becoming rapidly more of a norm. And I just happened to be sort of ready to graduate college right as that change was starting to take hold. And so it hadn't even occurred to me, in other words, to look into student game projects. I also didn't realize game design was a thing you could study in school because I thought it was all computer science or maybe art majors or writing, you know, like creative writing majors or something like that, who would then sort of finagle their way into the game industry. But the idea of actually getting a discrete degree in game design was, and in fact, this was the first year of that program. It was the inaugural class. So anyway, like I said, medium length version of the story. I met this guy, he was studying game design. And of course I was like, well, if you ever need music, hit me up. I'm a ravenous gamer. And it would be a dream to work on a game. And somehow my pitch did not alienate him. And he actually called me back and asked me to do his games. And I did his little student projects. And then about a month later, a classmate of his asked him if he could recommend a composer for his student projects. And this guy recommended me. So I get a cold email from a guy named Genova Chen, who says, I'm working on my master's thesis. I wonder if you could help me. And he was calling his master's thesis Flow.
Yeah.
Flow was a student project exploring a few different ideas, but among them was, can you make a compelling game whose principal emotional goal is one of a kind of meditative relaxation? Because at the time, that was effectively non-existent. Every Genova, whose big picture career goal was to explore mature content in games, by which he means earnestly mature. Mature in the way that Hemingway is mature or Shakespeare is mature, not in the way that, you know, explosions and violence and whatever are labeled as mature. The idea that something might mean something different to you if you play it as a 20-year-old versus as a 30 versus, you know, now I have kids or now I've lost a parent or whatever, as we hit these milestones in life, we see art through a new lens, and the most mature art is the one that somehow seems to age with you. You read Hamlet at 20 and it means something completely different than at age 40. He said, why aren't games trying to do that? And of course there are games. There have always been games like that, but they were much rarer in those days. And also none that explored anything outside of a narrow band of kind of adrenaline, largely sort of testosterone-y kind of emotions. Yeah. Genova said, why can't there be more? In fact, the little tagline for Flow was, life could be simple. And so I remember, all this was alien to me. I'd never imagined someone wanting to make a game like that, a relaxing game. It would be like a relaxing sport. It just seemed, it seemed unimaginable. And so I was totally blown away, struggled my way through making this little student project. And then it kind of blew up online and we got approached by Sony saying, would you like to remake this as a PS3 launch title? And so that game company was formed. We made Flow as a PS3 launch title. And it was the first of a 3-game deal that they signed, which led to Flower, which I was not part of, music for Flower by Vince Diamonti. And then 2009, they called me back and said, we're going to start on our third game. That game, we're calling it Journey, and would you like to be part of it? And from 2009 to 2012, we worked on it, and then Journey came out in March of 2012 and basically instantaneously changed my life. So there's the very medium-length version, skipping enormous amounts.
Yeah, of course. And it's difficult in a 40-minute interview like this to get into it.
But I just assume it's not interesting to give you every single detail anyway.
Do you get tired of, because you hear a lot of people who talk about the sort of the thing that made them artists sometimes, who don't like playing their most famous song, or actors who don't like talking about the superhero film they were in that made them famous, or Game of Thrones or whatever.
Right.
Do you ever get tired when, you know, we started this interview by talking about Journey, you know, and it's sort of obviously clear, like you just described it as the beginning of the rest of your career. Do you get tired of people only focusing on that one game? Because obviously, you know, since then, you've done some amazing work, but that is the game that seems to sort of get people's juices going.
I saw an interview once with Jeff Bridges where they said, you know, you won an Oscar, I believe it was for the film Crazy Heart.
Mm.
They said, you know, you've been in millions of movies, TV, all kinds of stuff, and yet for most people, you are forever the dude from The Big Lebowski. And does that bother you that for all you've done and seemingly higher artistic heights you've achieved, that's sort of inescapable? And he said, how lucky I am to have a role that still resonates with people, that they would remember it for that. He said, I will cling to the dude to my dying day with gratitude. I remember thinking that was the most beautiful sentiment. And to the extent that I can relate to that with Journey, I fully echo what he said. I've been very lucky in my career. I've never had a stretch of unemployment. I've had, you know, projects to work on. And even in the last few years, as we've seen a lot of tumultuousness in the game industry and a lot of studio closures and project cancellations. And I've certainly had my share of that, but I've never just suddenly found myself sitting on my hands. I've always had people who were interested in bringing me onto their projects. And I am immeasurably, truly, infinitely grateful to every one of those, because I always have this slight feeling that every time someone hires me, it's the last time I'm ever going to be signing on the dotted line to write a score. It just always feels like this really legitimately could be the last time that it happens. Because there are composers, you know, it's not some kind of weird false modesty. There are composers that are absolute heroes of mine where I look back at their career, you know, like there's some composers who were really big in the 70s. And then at some point they just stopped working. And I always think, what happened? Because they were, you know, just the absolute, you know, leaders of the field. And then it somehow something changed. And I sort of live in perpetual fear of that. And I don't take it for granted, but you are not wrong. Journey seems to cast by far the longest shadow. And even despite, I've been very lucky to work on some really cool and even some sort of groundbreaking projects. But Journey forever seems to be that one, to which I just say, I know composers, I have friends who are by every measure successful that don't lay claim to anything like Journey in their career. They've just sort of, they've always had work, they've always had jobs, but they've never had something like that.
Yeah.
And so I know it's not a given. It's not a guarantee. And by statistical odds, it'll never happen again, even if I remain up to my ears in work for the rest of my life. So I feel insanely lucky about it. Plus, on top of that, I remember when Genova first described Journey to me, when it was literally, there wasn't even concept art from Matt Nava yet. It just was an elevator pitch. We were literally at the flower launch party, and he pulled me to the side and said, I have an idea of what I want to do next, and can I tell you about it? And I remember I was 24 when he described Journey to me, having been a gamer, like I said, essentially my whole life. Let's say I started gaming at age 4, so I'd been a gamer for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, by my mid-20s, I was starting to kind of, you know, I'd really started to think, what else is there? I love... you know, strategy games. I was big into Warcraft and Starcraft, and I loved, you know, like all the LucasArts point-and-click adventures. It was hugely important to me, like Grim Fandango, Monkey Island, and Full Throttle, and The Dig, and the Sierra, you know, King's Quest, Space Quest, Police Quest, Leisure Suit Larry, all those kinds of games. Plus, you know, the big glossy, you know, your Call of Duty, your Medal of Honor, all of that. But
it's a menagerie. It's a buffet of delights when it comes to your gaming experience.
Absolutely. And I loved them all, but I was still, you know, when you hit your mid-20s is with that first, that early time where you start going, what else could there be? And I remember when he described Journey, I said, I could never have come up with this pitch for this game. And yet, the moment you said those words, I realized I've been waiting my whole life for someone to make a game like this. As a gamer, I've been waiting for someone to make a game like this. I was so excited by what it had the potential to be. Of course, there was also part of me that said, how they'll stick this landing. Yeah, this is a non-trivially ambitious concept. Yeah. I don't know if we're able to do this. I don't know if we're capable, but I felt so lucky to have a front row seat to what seemed like my dream game. Mm. It's not even like, for example, there are interviews with John Williams where they ask him about Star Wars and he makes it sound like, you know, look, this was a cute movie that I thought would be for kids, and color me surprised that 50 years later, we're still talking about Star Wars, and I've had the opportunity to score all these other Star Wars movies, and I conduct the music in concert all the time all over the world. But to him, Star Wars, the first time he saw Star Wars, he did not go, this is my dream movie. Because he just, you know, in fact, movies in general, I don't think were even John Williams' dream. You know, he was a sort of a classical musician and a jazz musician, and he kind of fell into film scoring, and he's really good at it. But, you know, I think if he could, I'm obviously sort of being a little bit speculative here, but from everything I've heard him say for the last 40 years, it would seem that if he could snap his fingers and have his dream life, it would be being, you know, like a symphonist and a composer of concertos and making jazz records or something like that. You know, he comes from an era where that was what being a so-called serious musician was. And film scoring, you know, he elevated film scoring in so many ways to something that forced the classical music community to see it as serious. But I think he himself was guilty of actually not seeing it as serious art, if he's being truly honest with himself. I did not see Journey that way. I was like, I can't believe my luck that I could be part of as a gamer, it looks like my dream game. So I love that it's still a part of my life. It's a long-winded way, very circuitous way of answering your actual question, that I feel so grateful to be part of it. And somehow I'm not embarrassed by the music. Usually once things are about 6 months old, I look at them and I go, oh my God. But you know, I don't know.
I'm the same. Perfect. When I rewatch old television programs I presented, or listen to myself presenting radio on the first time, I'm like, oh gosh, what is that? Oh, why have I done that like that? But it's good that you clearly, you know, this is one of those projects that stayed with you. I suppose getting into the art of making, of the work itself then, Austin, I can remember being very fascinated. I went once did a feature about the making of Destiny, and I interviewed Michael Salvatore, who people don't know helped create the Halo soundtrack. And he was showing me and explaining to me the nature. This is the first time I'd come across this, of the branching narrative of music. And you talked earlier on about it being an interactive medium, because, of course, you've got to make a score that can change on the flip of a coin, on the decision of a game, of a player, to take the story in one of infinite different directions. How on earth do you practically do that? You know, because you're not in charge of, you're not the river that's flowing downstream. You could be going in any direction, and you've got to be ready for that. How on earth do you even start?
The first question is always figuring out where those parameters actually are, because your analogy actually perfectly demonstrates what those first questions ought to be. So, for example, an open world game, it actually does present you with the ability to technically not do anything, but do a potentially wide range of very different things, right? So it's sort of like being in a boat in the ocean. Most games that are not open world games, and so it's more like a river system where you have a lot of moments of branching. Now, it might be really complicated, and it might also be a system that involves branches that eventually lead back to where you were versus some that are in a perpetual march forward. It starts getting into this immediate question of, well, what is the game's inherent design? You know, Journey, for example, is actually pretty linear. You don't have infinite options at any given time in Journey. The only thing that you really have, in theory, infinite of is how long you want to decide to do things. Like, you could theoretically spend infinite hours in Journey if you want. There's no time limits or things that force you to move forward. So we do have to design with this in mind of, you know, okay, like when I'm working on a game like Journey, I say, okay, player starts, they enter this area X at this point. What are all the things that they can do in this space? And mercifully, in a game like Journey, there's really only a few options of what you can do. But of course, the player doesn't necessarily know what those are at first. So the act of discovery for them is what they are taking their time on. But when I'm talking to the game designers, I go, okay, I need to know, though, like, let's say they knew what they could do and they just had it as a task list almost. What are those things? about how long do we figure they'll take? And then crucially, you know, what is the maximum amount of time that that could take? Maybe it's infinite. And what is the fastest, if we speed run it, what is the absolute fastest time? So then I start breaking that down and going, okay, player enters this area in Journey. Let's, you know, like, okay, I'll use the second little chunk of gameplay just because it's easy to use as an example. The second little area is where you're in this kind of bowl with these like sand waterfalls all around you. So it's kind of like you're in a little valley. And you, after you poke around, you realize that the way out is by opening up these little derelict machines, and it releases little cloth magic things, and you build a kind of bridge that ramps you up out of the area, right? So it's kind of like very low impact puzzle to solve, right? It's not actually difficult because there's not a lot of things to do that could sort of trick you or anything. But you have to figure it out. And of course, this is the first area in the game where you can interact with another player. The first area prior to this, your system will not connect you with somebody else. It forces you to be alone for the first few minutes of the game. So you may or may not meet with someone, and then it's a question of, all right, there's three of these little machines to unlock. Does the order in which you unlock them matter? Turns out not. Turns out they will each equally contribute to the three segments of the bridge that you need in order to get out. Then the question is, after we've solved it, we have to then present to the player, okay, now we're showing you the bridge out. Will the player go straight there? And when they get on the bridge, you know, can they jump off, start again? All these little forks in the road deciding, you know, what could happen. And so then I just start breaking it down. And so often what that means is I write little placeholder pieces of music that I mock up with my computer. We implement it into the game, and then I playtest it. The team playtests it, and we say things like, "Oh, I think this piece. I thought that the player would put together the bridge really fast, and so I wrote just like a little 30-second chunk of music. But it actually, we playtested it for 15 people, and it average took them 6 minutes. Well, that means they heard this little 30-second fragment 12 times. It got pretty annoying, actually, after 12 times. So I should make it longer, or I should make it a little more inobtrusive, or I should do other things to kind of mitigate that. So it's just, you know, and again, a game like Journey is mercifully linear that I can kind of take it scene by scene. A game like Assassin's Creed Syndicate or The Pathless or, you know, Lego Fortnite or any of these others that are way more open world, wildly different approach. We go, okay, well, how do we even break down, you know, what the player could be doing? It can be done the same way, but obviously the variables are way more extreme, and so it becomes a lot more arduous. Long and short of it is, it's a good thing that we frequently have a couple of years to tackle these, because on some level, if I'm being totally honest, it's a lot of trial and error. You know, because it's amazing how I've done something like 60 games, and it's amazing how little previous games help you when starting a new one, because each one ends up being so unique where you go, oh, well, you know, yes, it's an open world, you know, like, okay, it's Assassin's Creed. Yes, it's open world, but vertical traversal with a rope launcher was a particular thing to Syndicate. Well, that really changes the player's rhythm and their ability to move around the world really fast, you know, or like, I didn't work on the Insomniac Spider-Man games. That's John Paisano. But like, you're more likely to use fast travel in Assassin's Creed than you are in Spider-Man, because the traversal Spider-Man swinging was so intoxicatingly wonderful that then impacts your thinking. Whereas, you know, you kind of assume people are probably going to use fast travel on Syndicate. Well, that influences how you're going to approach sort of the open world aspect to it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's just a lot of, I mean, look, I keep notebooks where I write down a lot of what I'm doing, because it's so often just sitting there and staring at a piece of paper going, I guess it makes sense if we do this into that, into this.
So do you draw like little, I don't know, like maps, I suppose? So you've got your main theme of a section, say, you know, I mean, you don't have levels in games like you used to, but say, you know, an area in Lego Fortnite, you'd be like, okay, right, Chris, so if they're in this bit, this is the sort of theme. And then if something dangerous happens, then we're going to take them off in this direction. And have you got spider diagrams for days, Austin? Is that what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. We make flow charts. We make all kinds of things, because there's a talk. I mean, if someone's actually really curious about this, I did a talk at GDC a number of years ago about Assassin's Creed Syndicate that you can see on the GDC YouTube channel. That was called, it's called Waltzing with Blades. is the name of the talk, and I gave it with Christian Packard, who was the music supervisor at Ubisoft, and he and I designed this whole music system, and we put up the diagrams on screen where we say things like, okay, in like the combat music system in Assassin's Creed, you know, one of my pet peeves when playing those games, because I was a big fan of the franchise, was, you know, you come up behind someone, you assassinate them with their with your hidden blade, they go down inside of a second. The music registers that combat has begun, so it starts getting all excited, but you've done an instant kill. There's no combat. And so I said, you know, we need to design a system that's smart enough to realize when you're actually changing the mood or not. So we said, you know, I said, let's develop a whole algorithm of what we called threat assessment, where, you know, if it's a guy that's super weak compared to you, it has to be comparing you versus them, because of course you're leveling up and they're leveling up as mm-hmm. you enter more dangerous areas. So it needs to be a relative sense of danger, not they're level 10, because if I'm level 1, they're level 10, that's very dangerous. If I'm level 50 and they're level 10, they're trivially nothing, right? So it has to be comparative. It requires bringing in the engineers to say, we need some programmer support for our music system, because we need to be able to develop a number that the music system can actually understand. It can get crazy technical, and I'm trying to spare our listeners the sort of more dry aspects of it. But I think it's really cool. Where that little flirtation with programming and whatnot that I had in my teenage years really has served me well, because I love thinking this way of saying, all right, if we develop a variable, a number that is all about relative danger, then if we fall below that number, like if it's a low level dude that we just want to take out because, you know, we're bored or whatever, in a game like Syndicate, it won't even try to start combat music. It won't react, because it says this is not fundamental mood change. Because I said, I think music needs to be about the relative danger. And if there is no danger, there should be no music. Hmm. Now, then it becomes this series of gradations where, okay, then we have sort of medium encounters that call for medium music, which is a whole music system of itself. And then we have sort of high danger encounters, like if you pick a fight that you're likely to lose, or like you've wandered into an area of town that you're too low level for, that sort of thing. Then we need high level danger. And then you can see in our little flowcharts in the talk that the music, it's kind of like a roundabout in traffic, where you might enter a music loop that then is looking every time you come to one of the exits, you come to these checkpoints where it's going, how far are you in the fight? Have you kind of neutralized the threat? If so, we'll hit one of the exits out of our roundabout, but we'll enter into a different roundabout that's basically scanning the radius around us and saying, are there other guys that are potentially going to get aggroed by this fight that come join it to kick us back into danger? Or can we start a process of stair-stepping down? Because that had been another one of my pet peeves, is game music that has this very binary, you're in combat and then you're out of combat. And so you're in this whiplash like a sawtooth wave, switching back and forth, on, off, on, off. Whereas I said, it should be smooth like a sine wave where we're getting in and out of it. So think about it. Have you ever gotten to a big fight or like a heated argument with somebody? The adrenaline leaves your system gradually. You don't just suddenly walk out of the room and go, okay, I'm fine. Anyway, what were we doing?
Yeah.
And so I said, the music, since music is supposed to be a proxy for the emotion, it should do the same. We should be slowly leaving the experience.
And then how difficult is it to create music and create chords, to create chord progressions and instrumentation? Or is it instrumentation that allows you to ramp up and ramp down whilst also but keeping within the same melody? Because that's what I found amazing, is that you can never really hear the joins. If you listen really closely, like, okay, come on, when's the music's kicked in, but it still sounds so seamless. How do you do that? Is it instrumentation? Is it the musicality itself? Is it how you write the music? What is it?
It's literally all those things. It's a very savvy question, because honestly, what you've just tapped into is like my white whale that I'm chasing every time, that I never feel like I've ever gotten quite perfect. Like, for example, it's great for you to have said what you just said, warms my heart, where you said, I can't really, I don't remember how you phrase it, but sort of like, you don't feel the seams. You can't really.
Yeah. I can't hear the join. I'm listening
the
for
joints,
the, yeah, I'm an audio nerd. I'm a radio presenter. You know, I listen, I'm listening for the sting, for the whoosh, for the something that's covering this noise to
so
that noise.
You know our tricks. So, you know, yes, there are a lot of these tricks that help us. And obviously we're writing the music, bearing in mind that music is most of the time, not the only thing you're hearing, because there are sound effects and there might even be menu and kind of UI sounds. Like, I've just finished playing Expedition 33, for example, and the UI with its kind of persona-esque sense of constant motion and sort of cinematicness, that masks a lot because you know, you have all these whooshes and things just coming from the UI. And that could be your best friend as a composer, trying to sort of hide in the shadows of those brief little moments. But it won't get you everything. The real key, if you really want to try to see how seamless it is go play a game and turn off all the sound, go into the menu and turn off all the sounds other than music. And I do this constantly. Whenever a friend of mine releases a new title and I'm curious to try and diagnose what they did, I will frequently, I put it under the most unflattering possible light, in other words. And sometimes yeah. you can really, it's sometimes mind-blowing where you realize, wow, it's still so seamless when you play it that way. That's certainly how I play test my own projects. I turn off all the sounds and I go, I want to see if I can pull this off without relying on all those extraneous things to help mask these transitions. Long and short of it, all the things that you rattled off are what we lean on to solve this problem. So because I mentioned Journey, for example, at the beginning, we were talking about Tina Guo, the cellist who plays all the solos in the original recording of Journey. And Journey immediately presented this conundrum because I said, I want the music to be deeply interactive where it felt like every step you take through this world, the music is looking over your shoulder and seemingly writing the music in real time just for you. I want it to feel not just like, okay, I get it. There's a loop for this chunk and then a loop for this chunk or whatever. But it just feels like the analogy I always make, this is my comic book nerd side of myself, but I always loved Iceman from the X-Men where he's like on this bridge that's forming 1 foot in front of him. So it's like the world, you can go anywhere, but you're actually on a bridge that's just materializing directly in front of you. I said, I want the music to kind of have that quality where it feels like it's just for you. We're making a thing that you're walking on, and no matter where you walk, it will just appear right in front of you, right at the crucial moment. That's the illusion that I'm trying to create. Now, yeah. How do I reconcile that with the fact that I have this world-class talent in the form of Tina Guo and the others who also played on Journey, where the key to appreciating a brilliant performance is letting it go. You know, Tina Guo is not, I mean, she could literally play one note and it would be brilliant and probably tear your heart out. But let her play for 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, and actually build shape and make choices in the same way that, you know, do you really judge a great actor by a single word or a sentence or maybe a paragraph or a whole monologue where you really see the kind of storytelling architecture that they are able to imbue it with? Performances are no different. So I found myself, and I still to this day am struggling with this. You have these two contradictory goals. How do I write music that gives a performer a chance to really shine, which requires unbroken linear time versus the non-linearity of wanting the player to be in charge? So Journey was like my first, I mean, Flow has this to a degree, but Flow is a lot more about the interactivity than the kind of musicality of it. I will fully acknowledge it was the first step for me to really get my hands dirty on interactive music. But then Journey, I said, I need it to feel emotional while not feeling unresponsive to the unpredictable whims of the player. I'm still chasing this. I actually, funny enough, I'm doing an event with IGN in the next few days about this new game that just came out called Towerborn. With Xbox, where this was again the fundamental challenge, and I tackled it a way I've never quite tackled it before, because the music is this giant orchestral sound, very much as a slight love letter to the Studio Ghibli kind of aesthetic, and you know, it's more like the spirit of what Miyazaki's trying to create emotionally than less the literal music of Joe Hisaishi.
Yeah.
Although I love Joe Hisaishi's music, and it's sort of inevitably a bit of a love letter to him as well. But the point is, that's music that makes this challenge even more extreme, because it's long phrases of melody and things like that, that if you crossfade and do all the sort of normal tricks, it's so patently obvious that it doesn't sound like that music anymore. So it became this real challenge of how do we make something that's super seamless? And I want to believe we managed to come up with something. Again, if people watch our little event with IGN, I'll put a video up on YouTube explaining as well
absolutely
how it worked. But it's everything you just asked. Sorry.
Think no. If people are listening to this and they want to deep dive into this stuff, Austin. So this absolutely for sure. Like, make sure you signpost that stuff because people will be really interested. Look, I'm very aware that you are a busy man. You've got loads of other things to do. So we've only got you for less than 10 minutes. So if you don't mind, I've got some quicker fire questions for you.
Sure. Austin, forgive my. This is winding answers here.
No, this is fascinating. That's why we've got you on, because we want to deep dive into this stuff. It's really interesting. How you've that circle. Like I still can't, even listening to you talk about it now, the challenge of especially when trying to get vocals in it, or emotive bits of music that need that time to breathe, to hit that note and let it sink in. Anyway, fascinating. Do you find it difficult to jump genres? Because when it comes to like the writing of stuff, we talked a lot about the sort of the technical challenge of making it work with the player choice and the interactivity and what have you. Do you find it difficult to hop between the Banner Saga and Lego? Do you find the different genres? Because musicians who are in an indie band or hip hop musicians or house DJs or whatever tend to stick to their lane, don't they? But how do you find hopping between different genres?
To me, it's the lifeblood of what I do. I have this whole shtick I give about there's a difference between style and genre. We sometimes use those words interchangeably, and honestly, in conventional conversation, it's perfectly fine to use them interchangeably. But for me, genre is like a term of convenience, mostly, that just kind of describes a bit of the expectations we might have about what we will hear in a piece of music based on a few words we use. Like if I describe a piece as sinister horror orchestral music, you immediately can picture a few likely cliches. But maybe realistically what you will hear in that piece. Or if I say it's like old school, late 80s hip hop. There are certain things that you're just likely to hear, right? But it's mostly a term of convenience. It's kind of like I always said, it's more about record stores wanting to know how they can group things just to make their shelves make sense. Like it's not anything technical per se.
Yeah.
Style is something way more personal. And the analogy I like to use here is style is me. It's literally the human being. Genre is the clothes that I put on. So I can wear something crazy, Joseph's amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, crazy, flashy, audacious, Elton John or what was that? Liberace like style outfit. Or I can put on, a monk, a Jedi robe that's plain and brown. The human being in those two separate outfits is still the same person. And on some level, your clothing type might sort of alter your behavior, but the fundamentals of the human being is still going to be there. And so I love sort of bringing my voice, whatever that means, honestly. I don't even know how to self-diagnose what it is that makes me me.
Yeah.
But I love, I'm sort of led by that curiosity to go new places all the time and say, oh, I wonder what happens if I take this and I mix it with that and I try this. And so, yeah, for me, some musicians, as you rightly say, become sort of obsessed with a single method of communication through music, right? Mm. There's like a certain sound or whatever that just really seems to come out of them every time that way. And all power to them. I've always been in many ways the opposite. Once I do a thing and I feel like, okay, I've done that, I try to never do it again, really. Yeah. And that's where Jerry Goldsmith is my ultimate hero. One, I think the greatest composer to have ever worked in film, because he's the ultimate example of this. He has such a strong voice as a composer. I can clock a Jerry Goldsmith score within three bars. Mm. But yet he did jazz music, he did electronic music, he did avant-garde music, he did sweeping, lush, old-fashioned romantic music, he did very modern, cold, modernistic or expressionistic music, atonal music, small music, big music, music with voices, music with everything you could name. he did it. He did a ton of movies and television shows and things, and the most eclectic composer you could name. And yet he was always very clearly Jerry. And to me, it was discovering his music at age 10 that made me want to be a composer. And I like that as a kind of a philosophy for myself, you know, it's not the sound itself that I hope to be defined by. It's more the philosophy of the approach.
And slightly contradictory to your answer there, this next question. Mm. What's your favorite instrument to use in games? Because obviously it's just contradicting exactly your answer.
No, I mean, it's you're not wrong. I try to not really stay in one place. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't love instruments as much as I love performers. So Tina Guo, who I've mentioned a bunch of times, I end up writing a lot for the cello because I love Tina. She's a dear friend. We've known each other for 20 years. And when she plays the cello, something magic happens. And so, you know, she's featured heavily on Journey. She's featured heavily on Assassin's Creed Syndicate. She's featured heavily on, I did a game called Erica, a Sony London PlayStation title. She's featured heavily on that, et cetera, et cetera. Kristen Nagus is a musician I work with. She's a woodwind player, principally an oboe player, but she plays hundreds of instruments, literally, you know, penny whistles and duduk and neighs, and you know, it goes on and on and on. She plays instrument, basically every wind instrument that exists, you know, all the orchestral Western ones and saxophones and all the rest of it, but then also all the kind of folk instruments from seemingly every culture on the planet. And I love her to death. I love writing for her. So I always just look for an excuse to find. In fact, we've come to this new thing where she'll find an instrument maker, someone who literally makes instruments by hand somewhere. Like, we just had this on a new game that's coming out soon called Sword of the Sea. In fact, they're literally announcing the release date of that today as of when we're recording it. And so that Sword of the Sea is one where she found this guy that makes these Native American style multi-chamber drone flutes, and I commissioned it for her, had it mailed to her, and we're featuring it as so it's an instrument that exists one of a kind. So it's like, what's my favorite instrument? Well, the instrument is sort of Kristen, whatever's coming,
the person,
whatever she's got in her mouth in that moment. And likewise, Tina, and I have a handful of others that I just adore.
Last couple, just to finish up.
No worries.
These next two are nasty questions. So I'd like to apologize in advance. What is your favorite game soundtrack that is not your own?
That phrasing is so funny to me, as if I would pick my own.
So you never know. Some people might, or they might say, you know what, that Erica banger, that's my favorite. You know, you never know.
I've never. It's funny. I'm always very quick to move on. Like I said, despite everything I said about my gratitude towards Journey, I never just sit back and listen to my own music. It's like listening to my own voice. Like, I guarantee you, I will not listen to this episode of this show because I can't stand
it. Just share it on social media, Austin. It's fine. You don't
have to. That I'm more than happy to do.
You don't actually have to listen. It's fine.
But yeah, no. So I mean, look, it's really hard to pick a true all-time favorite. I think Peter McConnell's music to Grim Fandango was really, really influential because I loved it to death. I've always had a soft spot for both the Mexican idiom of like mariachi and the kind of Mexican folk music that's even like the stemming from the Aztec traditional music, which is, you know, only partially understood sort of archaeologically, but I've always loved that stuff. It spoke to me a lot. I grew up in Colorado. It was an enormous exposure to Mexican culture there, and I always had a deep love for it. But I also loved the sort of father traditions of Spanish music and the Catalan and all that, the profound romance of the music of Spain has always spoken to me. And to hear that mixed in with this greasy film noir jazz sensibility, just that alone was so powerful and amazing to me.
Yeah.
But then that was an early CD-ROM game, which meant it didn't rely on hardware playback, so-called chiptunes, like most games, you know, up to that point. It was able to play back off the CD real recordings. And Pete went and got these musicians that had such personality, just like I was talking about with Tina and Kristen. So much of why I think I hold that at a high level is because I heard as a teenager music being played like that, where Peter didn't just go find a random saxophone player. He went and found a specific person who had this dirty, nasty style. So when you're in Hector Lemann's office in, you know, the city of I'm suddenly blanking on the name. I'm ashamed to say because I love Grim Fandango so much. But when you're essentially the land of the dead, you're talking to this guy who's your boss, and he's a total like old school film noir gangster, and you have the saxophone solo that's not just any sax solo. It's that guy. You know, it's, I remember he got the bass clarinetist who plays with Tom Waits, for example, to play on those scores, and it's like, it's not a normal bass clarinet, so that sort of thing. I remember I just thought,
yeah,
it's not just an instrument that you write for, it's a person. And so I have a lot of other scores that I cherish to absolute
You've given it a big sell there on Austin. We've got an Ultimate Games playlist on Spotify we've put together. So we'll have to stick this.
Yeah, put it on there, absolutely.
Grim Fandango is going on there, absolutely. And then just to finish, what advice would you give someone who's listened to this and is keen to get into the industry, wants to be writing music for games at the moment? What would you say to them in terms of how to go about trying to find a space in the industry? Like, you know, you happen to bump in to friends that became colleagues in your uni days. What advice would you give to others?
I'll give you a couple bullet points if you indulge me being wordy one last time. First off, what you just said is the most important thing by far. I have this whole spiel I like to give when I talk to students about don't network. Networking is literally sociopathic behavior, because networking is interacting with someone with the sole intent of figuring out how they can help your career. It's not meeting someone. It's not getting to know them. It's how can you serve me? You know, if anything, your interactions with people can be, how can I serve you? But maybe not even that. Maybe let's just get to know each other and become friends. And then if I meet 100 people and I become friends with 50 because we just get along great and we click, maybe of those, one or two will later turn out to have professionally meaningful consequences, because it turns out that they introduced me to that person or that person, blah, 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 blah. But you only do that kind of thing with people who are your actual friends. And so I always say, don't network, just get to know people and have patience, recognizing that most of the people you get to know, you're just adding a nice person to your life. That's all that's happening there. Is that a bad thing? That strikes me as a wonderful thing. Some small subset of these lovely people that you are collecting in your life and that who you care about will end up being a work thing. I always say, I like to work with people ideally. The kind of people I like to work ideally with are people that it would not seem bizarre and out of left field if I got an invitation to their wedding or to the, you know, something like that. Where I go, we're friends first. Now, of course, I have a lot of professional relationships that I don't want to mischaracterize my career. I have a lot of professional relationships, but that's always the goal. And I always like to start immediately getting to know the people I'm working with on a very personal level, because it's so much more enjoyable and it's so much more creatively stimulating to work with people. So my fundamental advice above all is sort of don't rush to just start power networking. And like, I get it. It's an existential crisis from the first seconds. Cause you go, how am I going to put food on the table? That's a Kobayashi Maru question. It is an unwinnable scenario because you just, everyone has to solve that their own way. There's no trick to it, but I can definitely tell you that your career will be served best longer the more you don't let that drive your interactions with people. The only other thing I would add is you know, I'm always encouraging people to be as, you know, honing their craft as much as humanly possible. I spend a lot of hours at my desk. I spend a lot of time, you know, just off camera here, I have piles of sheet music, a classical repertoire, and I constantly buy new books, and I really try to be learning about.
And you play all the instruments as well, Austin?
Oh Lord, no! I like conducting the orchestra, and I'm a medium level pianist. But my whole passion is in writing music, handing it to the professor. I literally was texting. I have a recording session for a game next week, and I had some unique things that I was asking a trombonist to do. And I literally texted a fragment of sheet music an hour before we jumped on this call to a trombonist friend of mine, and said, Is it clear to you what I'm asking based on how this is notated? And he says, yeah, that's totally clear. It would help to give an explanation. So it's like, no, I am always, looking to learn more. So that was what I was driving at, is I always encourage musicians and composers to spend, there's no amount of knowledge that's ever going to be too much. As John Williams loves to say, music is enough for a lifetime, but a lifetime is not enough for music. No amount of training and practice and learning will ever be enough. But do not forget to get away from your desk and go out, touch grass, as they say, fall in love, have your heart broken, have drinks with friends, learn hobbies that are not related to you. You cannot fill your well that all that training is supposed to be in service of plumbing the depths of, if you're not filling it with life that informs it, informs your choices, that shapes who you are.
Yeah.
And I was really bad about that in my 20s in particular. I just spent all my time writing music. And at some point I started to look around and realize, I think there's a lot of living I'm missing out on. And it's not that I regret it. I had a great experience. Life comes at you. It forces surprises on you, but
yeah it does.
But yeah, that's always the advice I give. I say you have to reconcile the contradiction between putting in an enormous amount of work to try to be a master of your craft as much as you possibly can, while recognizing that that's all in service of nothing if you don't have anything to say. And you won't have anything to say if you don't go and experience the world in this brief little window that we're allowed to do that. And so how you reconcile those two things, I'm still trying to figure that out for myself. It's a challenge, but I do think it's an important one.
Well, it's great advice, and I really appreciate you sharing it. Well, Austin, it's been a joy chatting to you for the last hour or so. It's been really interesting getting a peek behind the curtain of what goes on and the challenges you face and how you try to overcome them. It's been brilliant. So thank you very much for taking the time and talking to us.
No, thank you for the invitation. I'm honored. I don't take it for granted, and thank you for having me.
That's great. We do something really silly on our podcast where we ask people if they have an unpopular gaming opinion. Could be about anything. Mine has been mine is that the GameCube controller is the greatest controller ever created. do you happen to have one you can throw away as a bombshell to finish the episode on?
I could not get into Undertale. I bounced off it hard. I want to love that game, but I just couldn't. I could not for the life of me figure out. I never finished it, and I think I probably should. Undoubtedly, I should. But I'm never one to turn my nose up at a thing that's pervasively popular. In fact, I think if I bounce off of a thing that's pervasively popular, I'm probably the limiting factor. I'm the problem there, because you don't resonate with millions of people by accident.
Yeah.
But I gotta say, one of the most popular games ever, and it didn't do anything for me.
Well, on that bombshell, Austin, it's been a joy. Thank you very much for taking the time, and we'll speak to you soon. All the best.
Thank you.